Howdy. As some of you may have noticed, the talk here isn't quite what's on the present or on the handout. We'll get to explain that in a minute. First, I guess there's some administrative stuff. Immediately following us, Ophir Arkin will be on stage, and then after that, we'll have Robert Grill and Michael Cohen. I'm not sure what their talks are, but they asked me to announce it, so there we go. The original outline that we submitted for this conference was involving captive portals, and we still are going to discuss captive portals, but I think in general, this discussion is going to revolve around wireless security and basically discussion of some flaws in the current state of the art of wireless security, some potential ways to get around those flaws, and then some real-world examples on what people have deployed out there and what exists in the sense of community-based networking. People we have on stage, myself, I'm Bruce Potter. I'm founder of the Shmoo Group, and I'm just kind of a general network and security monkey for some big corporation that pays my bills. it's a good thing in this day and age to have somebody paying your bills. Adam Shan, the red-haired New Zealander next to me, founder of Personal Telco. It's a community-based networking project based out of Portland. Really interesting stuff that they're doing up in Portland. And on the end is Tony. He's also a member of the Shmoo Group. He's administrator of some Wisconsin 2600 boxes and co-founder of PRIC, which is possibly the worst acronym in the world. It's the Palmyra Rural Internet Cooperative, which I believe is what you're talking about today. Okay. Quick little couple philosophical thoughts, if you will. Been going to DEF CON for a while, and I come and sit here and watch some of the talks, and sometimes the speaker will say something that I don't agree with. And my biggest fear is when they say something that I don't agree with, that everybody else around me will nod and go, oh yeah, that's the way it is, because he said it so. We're human beings just like you guys. You know, we're up here telling it how we see it, how we interpret specifications, how we deploy, what our risks are. You know, we're all community-based networking people. We have completely different risks than people deploying wireless networks at IBM or Microsoft or Cisco or whatever. So we have our own world that we deal with. If you disagree with me, say it. If you feel something, if you're confused about something, ask or go home and play with it. We're up here to tell it from our side of the story. You go figure out your side of the story. Anyway, sorry. I get a little upset when I disagree with someone. So, second thought, wireless networking is kind of interesting because it's brought two different worlds together. You've got people who've come down the OSI stack from the top, application people, networking people, who got down to layer two and said, hey, we can do all this really neat stuff without wires. This is really great. And we keep playing with our routers and keep playing with our web servers and think everything's all dandy. And then you've got people that come at it from the bottom. They're RF guys. They really like EM fields and antennas and Yagis and all these other things. And Adam and I come down from the top. And we were lucky enough to meet up with Tony, who comes up from the bottom. So if you have RF questions, Adam and I will sit here and drool, and then we'll just look at Tony, and he'll answer the question for us. All right, so what are we going to talk about? What is wireless? Everybody's got a different definition for wireless. We'll talk about 802.11 security and insecurity, how to use portals to secure wireless networks, and then get into some real-world examples in the wonderful land of Wisconsin with cheese and cows and crazy 900 megahertz wireless. All right, so wireless, you go to any conference these days, and it's a really hot word. I think I've heard several conversations at DEF CON this year. What do you think the next big thing is? And, oh, it's wireless. What the hell does it mean? Lots of different acronyms. The big ones that people get all uppity about, WAP, 802.11, WEP, Wi-Fi, Home RF, Bluetooth. Just some words on some of the buzzwords that we've got up there. WAP is dead, at least in my opinion. And in its death, WTLS dies with it. That's the SSL-like protocol that secures WAP transactions. There are various reasons WAP is dead or will die in the near future, and that's a religious debate that we can have offline over some beers if anybody wants to get me drunk tonight. I have similar opinions with Bluetooth. There seems to be a lot of support in Europe for that, but there was a lot of support in Europe for SET as well, which if any of you remember SET, nice card processing protocol that's dead as a doornail now. And Home RF, I think, is on its way out as well. Intel backed out of Home RF, and that's pretty much the last we'll see of them, I think. There may be some niche markets, but I think Home RF will be another legend. Aider 2.11 is here. I mean, it's deployed. We're all roaming around this week using it. It's not hard. It's consumer grade. Everybody can buy it for a couple $100. It's easy to put onto silicon. They're getting a lot better at putting it onto silicon, getting better with the power constraints. I think that's the real protocol that people are going to be using. And I think that's going to end up supplanting things like WAP and things like Bluetooth, because people will shoehorn in solutions, you know. SSL was not the best solution for credit card processing, but everyone just kind of popped it in there and it worked. And I think 802.11 may not be the best solution to get data across your house from your little wireless headset to your cell phone, but people will find a way to shoehorn 802.11 into that solution, and it'll be here to stay. All right, 802.11's got lots of little parts to it, and I'm just going to kind of bomb through them. There was the original 802.11 standard that's been out for quite a while. You can read all the stuff on the board. Basically, it accounted for the basic stuff that you see in 802.11 today. It had infrastructure base where you have one central access point and everybody talks to that, or you could form an ad hoc network where people would just kind of talk to whatever the hell they wanted to talk to. It was limited to 2 megabit rate due to the FCC, and whatever. You can read this slide. 802.11b solved problems with 802.11. 802.11 had some issues, not the least of which was the differentiation between frequency hopping and direct sequence. Now 802.11b DSS is the only way to go, at least as far as they're concerned. It still uses WEP. It still uses the 2.4 gigahertz range in the ISM band. It goes up to 11 megabits. And then the marketing people got a hold of it because it got hot, and they called it Wi-Fi or WiFi or whatever. If you see WIFI stamped in your card, it just means it's 802.11b. Some marketing person put that there. You can go find them and annoy them. So on the plate coming up next, 802.11a and G are where things are going. 802.11a uses the 5 gigahertz ISM band, and it goes up to 54 megs. I've heard rumors that Apple's hoping to have hardware shipping by the end of the year that will do 802.11 speeds, like right, you know, hopefully by December, I think is what they said, which would be kind of nice. You get your nice little titanium iBook at god-awful amount of price, and you jack in a $300 card, and you have 54 meg wireless, and probably cook your chicken on the end of the thing. 802.11g, again, just a different way to solve problems, getting you up to 22 megabits. Blah, blah, blah. Somebody will win. Somebody will have more money than somebody else, more marketing money, more technical money, and one of those standards will become the new dominant standard. And it's all CSMACA. So, security. Yeah, this is what we're here for, right? The basics of security: integrity, confidentiality, and availability. One thing about wireless: availability is a write-off. As Adam so eloquently put it, someone could stick a coat hanger in a microwave, aim it at your access point, and you're not going to be able to do anything. There's really nothing you can do. We could sit here, go to Home Depot, and build something in the next 25 minutes that would take down the access point here at DEF CON, and people would just be out of luck. So when you're dealing with security aspects of a wireless network, you're really concerned about availability above layer one, layer two. You're looking at normal IP availability issues, because nothing's going to stop someone from aiming big microwave at you. Integrity and confidentiality is really where the work has been done, some of the work has failed, and where everyone's trying to concern themselves right now. How do you keep the data secure in the air? How do you keep other people from injecting data into it? And how do you keep unauthorized people from accessing your network, if that's a requirement of yours? Some people don't care. And I hit the magic button that made it all go away. Hey, thanks. Okay, don't hit B whenever you're using PowerPoint. All right. So, like I was saying, wireless mediums in general are insecure. We all recognize this. EM waves go everywhere. You stand in a building, you pop up a radio, and unless you're inside a Faraday cage, the radio waves are going to go places you don't want. At one of my last jobs, I was responsible for EM shielding our data center, or a part of our data center for particular parts of our key management system, and it wasn't cheap. We built a 10 by, or attempted to build a 10 by 10 before the company ran out of money and we all went looking for other jobs. Attempted to build a 10 by 10 EM shielded room to be basically Tempest grade, and it was not cheap. So it's just a write-off. Waves are going to go everywhere you want. 1,000 foot is conservative with the right antennas. You know what you're doing. You can get a lot farther away than 1,000 foot. It's easy to sniff because it's right there. I mean, we stand here every day. We get inundated with 802.11 waves and satellite waves and everything. It goes through our body. Some people consider it our personal property once it enters your body, and then you can do whatever you want with it. not going to get into that. information just kind of leaks out. You know, you get in part of the protocol, you'll learn the station name. It's one of those things that shows up unless you're in Lucent and they think it's a secret, and it's not, it doesn't work so well. We'll get into that in a bit. AP location. You have a radio, you can triangulate it. You know where the access point is. You know, it's just a given. If you have something in your house, somebody can drive by and figure out that, oh, look, you have an access point. It's probably in that room right there. And because of that, you can data harvest. You can go out, find access points, log them, store them, put them on a map. This is great for community-based networks who like to know where their access points are. You go to a personal telco site and see, boom, 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 here are all the access points. But you can also, if you're Pete Shipley, go war drive around cities and just figure out where all the access points are. The Shmoo Group's got a database online. People can go just plug in access points and say, I found signal here, and here's the information I know about it, and other people can maybe go access it. And I think the WI-2600, they have something similar to that. So the security of the situation. WEP was the first shot at security. I think the major requirement for WEP was reflected in its name, wired equivalent privacy. They were hoping that you could treat the wireless shot like a wired shot. It seems kind of outlandish, and given what's happened to the protocol since it's been released, the holes have been punched in it, it's not really true. WEP is not wired equivalent anything. Basically, it's a shared secret between an access point and the client. And shared secrets are bad. Shared secrets involve trust. Giving trust to someone who is not trustworthy is bad. If you have a large network and you're trying to give all access to all these people to go access your network, giving them the key is not good. They will do something dumb with it. They will get hacked. They will give it to someone because they want one of their friends to go out and use the network. They'll post it on a bulletin board on the net. Whatever. It's just a bad idea. WEP uses RC4 for a stream cipher. RC4 is a fine cipher. Crypto doesn't break down usually in the actual math behind the crypto. It breaks down in the protocol creation, and that's what happened to WEP. there are 40-bit keys specified in the WEP spec. Vendors have extended that to 104-bit keys. It's not a rocket science maneuver. You know, it's there. It was using RC4. You just say use 104 bits instead of 40 bits. Boom. So now we have higher security WEP encryption. I'm going to skip the next. Oh, one neat thing. If you go to that URL at the bottom, there's a discussion on WEP key generation. If you use a passphrase, some of the WEP clients allows you to whack in a passphrase, and it generates these 40-bit keys for you, so you don't have to think of 5 hex characters because it's so hard to think of characters these days, and it'll just generate your keys for you. Well, apparently the algorithm that they use isn't really that secure and only generates about 21 bits of entropy and not 40 bits of entropy. Yeah, you're better off in that case just plugging in your own keys. Here's the structure of WEP. The keys on top, you either choose 40 or 104 bits of key material, and then there's an initialization vector of 24 bits that gets tagged on the end. So marketing people latched onto this and said, hey, you know, the key length is really 64 bits, so we can market our cards as 64-bit encryption instead of 40-bit encryption. It looks all that more impressive. And the same thing happened with 128-bit. I think by that time they'd really figured it out because you still saw 40-bit and 64-bit encryption cards floating around. But you never see 104-bit encryption. It's always 128. The marketing people had a couple months to spin up, and they said, oh, yeah, we'll just call it 128. So when you see 40-bit encryption and 64, it's the same thing. So what happens is you get your plain text, they perform a CRC check on it. Note, not a keyed MAC. These people are not doing authenticated, or not doing a keyed hash of the packet. They're just verifying the integrity of the packet. That becomes important. And then that's encrypted with K. They tag on the initialization vector on the front, so that 24 bits of key material that you thought you had in the 64 bit basically gets sent in the clear across the wire. Whoops, that's not really that impressive. And then they tag on some other extra header information. So that's the basic structure of a WEP packet. biggest problem with WEP. WEP totally ignores the issue of key management. It does make provisions for key enumeration where you say, I have key 1, I have key 2, I have key 3, and I have key 4, and I'm transmitting with key 1. And if the other person in their key 1 slot has the same key 1 that you have, you can decrypt and encrypt data to them. But it doesn't really make any other provisions beyond that. You end up having to give your keys to everybody under the sun. Lucent has one of their docs to describe, I think they're AP1000, they have a discussion on how to rotate the keys. And the key rotation policy involves putting all 4 keys on the client and then doing other things to the access point. Like, you rotate the keys in the access point in such a manner that the access point only has 1 or 2 keys on it at any given moment. If you think about the security of that situation, it doesn't make any sense because you've got all 4 keys given out on the untrusted host, and then on the host that you kind of trust, you only have 1 or 2 keys. So while it may make your life easier as a system administrator that you don't have to go manually keying keys on all your laptops every month, it's still a real, security-wise, it's exactly backwards from what you'd expect. So key management is really out the window. Sorry, I just want to check my notes here. Okay, so one of the biggest issues is really the key lifetime. Because the keys are living on the client machine, you assume they can be compromised. So when you're assessing your risk in your environment, you have to say, how long can my key live? And then how expensive is it for me to change these keys? How much does it cost me to go out and change the keys on all my laptops and all my whatever is connected to my network? If you're in a small little home office, you don't care. You know, you go sit down at your desk. If you've got 1,000 people in a big network, it's a real pain in the butt. So people will sacrifice longer key life for ease of administration, which just makes the situation all that much worse. So, real world example. This has happened. Al works somewhere. He's got his laptop. He goes home. He's rooming with some guy who's an elite hacker. Guy says, hey, can I have your keys? Oh, yeah, sure. I don't see the harm in that. Boom. Then Bob, the elite hacker, goes, sits in the parking lot of the big company and sniffs their network and runs around the file server and basically sits in the soft, squishy middle of, corporate America. Anyone who works in corporate America says, yeah, my network inside is like a Twinkie. We can all roam around and do whatever we want and access every server on the planet. And Bob now is doing that just like he's an employee and it's nearly undetectable. Other problem. You got a bunch of developers. They're in an office. One of them gets a taste of wireless at their house. One day decides, well, we got this meeting coming up and I want to sit in the conference room and access my, all my stuff like I'm sitting in my office. So I'll just bring my access point in. So the employee comes in, jacks in the access point. Hey, look at that. That's kind of fun. Other people bringing their wireless cards in. It becomes a permanent fixture. Network admins have no clue it's there. And you end up with companies now having to go around and do wireless audits of their buildings, walking around with software like NetStumbler or whatever they can lay their hands on, hoping to find access points and shut them down before somebody else outside in the parking lot does. So other wet problems. There have been several published papers. I won't bore you with the details. These guys are much smarter about this stuff than I am. But there's problems with the implementation of all of this stuff. From the access point standpoint, the code was rushed to market. People were just trying to get the code out there as fast as they could to make money. That's the bottom line of people building hardware. Be before anyone else. So you end up with really bad things happening. Administration is usually in the clear, usually always in the clear. No SSH, no SSL. It's usually web-based or telnet-based, and you could probably come in most of them and come right over the wireless shot and do it. Okay, that's a problem. That's a big problem. Also, the initialization vector on most of the cards will start with a predictable number, say 0, and iterate through up to a full 24 bits, and then boom, go back down to 0 and iterate straight through up again. That is, if it changes, some of them don't even bother to change the initialization vector. So you get into this really interesting attack that these guys discovered that through the initialization vector reuse, you can potentially get clear text data out of the stream. When you start at 0, and the box usually sends the same packet to start every single time, you know that plain text, and you know the initialization vector. You wait 24 bits worth of packets, which is about a half a day on a network that's moderately busy, and then boom, you'll get another packet with the same IV that you recognize. You can take that packet and the first packet, munge them together, and you end up with XORed plain text. And then if you know the first plain text, you can XOR out that plain text, and you're left with the plain text in the second packet. Kind of neat. you can apply that through the whole keystream if you can figure out the keystream, or you can just go and compromise the keys by social engineering, which is probably, in reality, the way more people are going to get the keys. The APs will also allow non-web traffic, which is kind of a bummer. People can get non-encrypted traffic into your network. That's not good. And 40-bit RC4 is, of course, brute forceable. I think I do. I got something up here. You can see me offline. Oh, it's also on the personal telco site. There'll be links at the end. You can find it. So, web attacks are still mostly theoretical, but it has been shot full of holes. Web is not wired equivalent privacy. It's just quite simply not. There is a gigantic deployed user base of 802.11 stuff out there right now, and it's going to continue to get larger. This is going to be where people are going. This is where everyone's shoehorning their solutions from, and this is what we need to be concerned about. So if you're a small office, you don't care. If you're a big company, you probably don't care too, but that's just more ignorance. I'm just going to – you can read authentication. It's a two-way authentication based on the web keys, and you can basically – authenticate the network without knowledge of the keys through breakdown of the protocol. So, what's the solution? You look higher up, layer 3 and above. MAC addresses can be changed, so you can filter on MAC addresses and use layered security. That's all fine and dandy. Layered security, you know, we all know this is a good thing, but it doesn't solve all your problems. Endpoint-to-endpoint encryption. Everyone says, oh, just use SSL and SSH. That's the solution. It's not always a solution. You can't always just arbitrarily employ SSL and SSH everywhere on the planet. You can do IPsec tunnels, VPN. This has become very popular, where you VPN off your wireless network into a local wired VPN host and bounce out to the internet. Or you can also do vendor-specific things like Lucent tries to hide the SSID, the station identifier, for the access point, treats it like a shared secret. So I'm going to hand off to the tall red-haired guy here, who I just met yesterday.
All right. First off, I just want to be really clear here that my focus when I'm presenting this stuff and what I'm going to be talking about is the captive portal is not on a corporate point of view. It's from building public networks, right? What Personal Telco does is we set up effectively rogue access points everywhere, hook them up to DSL lines with the idea that anybody can get access for free whenever they want, so long as they're within range, right? So this is not necessarily a corporate solution. This is something that I was looking to deploy in a open network. So my main goals are building public networks, encouraging other people to build public networks. So when I go to someone and say, hey, I'm doing this, I'm building a public network, I think it's cool, you should join up. And they say, well, why should I? Now somebody can hack my computers, right? I want to be able to provide them with something which will protect them, make them feel warm and fuzzy about how to do that, all right? So I want to protect the node operator. I want to protect the network from abuse. And I want to protect the organization, which is Personal Telco, from lawsuits or whatever. All right. So here's a quick little network diagram just so you can see what I'm talking about. This is like a very simple home network setup. You have your access point, you have a wireless client connected to it, you then have the portal, which is, in what I'm talking about, going to be a Linux box, it could be a Windows box, it can be anything which has firewalling tools on it that you can access. The portal basically acts as a firewall, bastion host, protecting the wireless traffic from your home network, and then there's an internet connection of some sort. All right, so the captive portal. Captive portals have been around for a while. Cisco, Nortel, a bunch of people being selling captive portal systems as a way to manage DSL customers. So they sell it as a part of their SMS subscriber management systems. I was working for a company that was a CLEC at the time, and they were looking at doing this as a way of provisioning DSL access. At the same time, I was starting up Personal Telco, and I thought, hey, if you can do this for DSL, you can do it for wireless, right? So the good things are all the tools you need are already out there. They're already open source. You can do this with a Linux box, a FreeBSD box. All you got to do is basically write some Perl, Python, Bash wrappers to do it. The main point of the captive portal is the problem is, especially as a service provider, is you don't want to have to support client software. So you don't want to have to give them a PPPoE client. You don't want to have to give them a DHCP client, which supports authentication. You don't want to have to support that. And the most generic tool you can use is the browser, because pretty much everything which has an IP address has a browser. So all you're doing is you're forcing them to the portal. The portal is a web page. You can enter in their username, their password, and get access that way. The web page that can then talk to the firewall and grant them access. So again, the primary point of the captive portal is account provisioning. It gives you audit trails, gives you a way to control access, turn off access, whatever, and gives you a way to control your network so that you can protect it from abuse. So it's a Linux box. There's lots of ways to provide secure authentication. Since it's just a web page or a CGI running off, right, you can use HTTPS, so there's no clear text passwords going over your wireless link. You can put whatever kind of authentication back in. You can use Radius, LDAP, the local password file, Kerberos. It doesn't matter. You can use whatever you want, whatever's convenient for you. You can use a central database of user information. You can use a local. Doesn't matter. It's very, very flexible. Basically, anything that Perl can talk to, you can talk to. So that's a good thing. So once they authenticate via the web page, what do? Well, they authenticate. You've already got all of their information from their HTTP session. So you can either update a firewall rule or you can set up a VPN tunnel for them. And then finally, you can apply quality of service rules at IP layer. And you can say, okay, I'm allowing you access to my network, but I'm only going to give you 10K or I'm only going to give you 50K or whatever. So what's good about captive portals? Good thing. Lots of authentication methods, right? You can do anything. It will scale. So you can use your local password file if you're just setting up something small at home, or you can use your corporate Kerberos network, right? Have secure tickets, all that fun stuff. All right, it's hackable. It's easy. You can probably write an entire captive portal line in a few hundred lines of Perl. It can scale, right? There's all sorts of stuff to scale web services already, and basically you're just utilizing that. It protects the node operator, so whoever it is that's running the node, right, they have an access point, they have a DSL line, they're letting anybody that wants to get access to their network. They want to be able to protect that. They can separate the wireless clients from their personal, you know, from all their unsecured Windows boxes. They can, so that's a good thing. It gives them protection, right? It also protects the network. So if you have somebody that just puts up an access point and they're connected in, because the long-term goal of Personal Telco and other free networking projects is that not only will there be these isolated nodes, but they'll all be interlinked. So you can get access from my house at my access point, but if my DSL line is down, you can then go out through the wireless network and get access out somebody else's DSL line. All right, so what's bad about captive portals? First off, if you're doing it with a VPN, VPNs are complicated, and not very many people understand them, and when they break, they're a pain in the ass to fix, right? That's the basic truth. They're great. They provide a lot of good stuff, but they're an extra layer of complexity that when people are doing stuff and building networks for free, you don't want to have to deal with. There's also not very many good and free Windows and Mac clients. There's lots of stuff under Unix. Very, very little that's good and free under Windows or Mac. So it changes the network topology, right? You now have tunnels going all over the place. Again, harder to troubleshoot. Now, without a VPN, the disadvantages are you lose your link encryption. It's hard to disconnect users. So you have a user sitting connected to your access point. They connect once. How do you know when to update your firewall rules to stop them having access? That's kind of a hard problem to solve. There are solutions, right? The captive portal can ping them every minute. That's kind of ugly. You can pop up a little web window so that with a meta refresh tag in it, so they now have a little window like net zero style, right? Which sits there with the Personal Telco logo and hits your files. And then you can just watch your log files. And if they haven't hit your log files for 5 minutes, you disconnect them. And the next problem is it can be spoofed, right? You're running open. You have to allow them either by IP or MAC address, and there's nothing to stop somebody else coming on, wait until they see somebody connect, spoofing their IP, spoofing their MAC address, and taking over their session. The biggest problem is fake nodes. So let's say you have a centralized authentication source, a centralized user database, and Bruce here hates Personal Telco and just wants to wreak havoc with it. So what he does is he sets up a node with a captive portal that looks just like ours. Users then come, they go, oh, I can type in my username and password and get access. Great. But all he's doing is harvesting the usernames and passwords that are entered, and now he can access our network as anyone. There are some ways to solve that. You can solve that with client-side certificates, right? but that's complicated, and no one really understands that. Or the other thing you can do is you can redirect the portal page to a centralized server, use SSL, have a certificate, but then you're relying on users to actually check that they're talking to the machine that they think they are and actually see what the cert is that they're talking to, and nobody's ever going to do that. And you have an additional network dependency in that the local node has to be able to talk to the centralized server in order for it to be able to work. So I decided I didn't like that idea. And I started talking with some of the guys from New York City Wireless, and we came up with the idea of the active portal. And the basic idea here is that what do you actually need usernames and passwords for? When you're running an open network, what do usernames and passwords actually gain you, right? You have to provision these accounts somehow. Do you allow them to dynamically provision the account? In which case, if you disable one account, why don't they just start up another one right away? Right, it's the same problem that Slashdot has. Somebody abuses one account, they do something with it, they just open up another account. Right, it's basically pretend security in an open model like this. So I've been interested in WikiWikis for a while. They're an open, no security, collaborative web environment, if you've never seen them. And so they have this concept of soft security. All right, traditional security is you restrict access in every way you can, right? And then you just poke holes through, you know, people present credentials in some form, and you allow them access to certain trusted areas. Wikis turn this around, and what they say is they say security gets in the way of people doing what they want to do. So what we will do is we will provide transparent to the end user security methods for them to go about doing their job. So you don't have to authenticate, but you implement things like rate limiting so that they can't change your web page more than X amount of times a minute because nobody can type that fast. You keep backups, so if somebody trashes a page, you can revert it, right? It's all about providing security on the back end so that nobody can actually do any significant amount of damage. So I thought that this idea worked better with the idea of open networks, right? We talked about using extrusion detection or reverse intrusion detection, and basically the idea is you take an IDS and you flip it around. Instead of watching for traffic coming into your network, you watch for traffic that's leaving your network, right? You're providing an open node. You're allowing anybody to get access to the internet through you. So what you're doing is you're watching for people hacking from your node. You're watching for people sending spam from your node. And if they do that, you turn them off. Now, it's true that they can just immediately reconnect different MAC address, different IP address, and get access. But as soon as they do a bad thing, they're turned off again. So the primary aim of the active portal is to stop network abuse and to stop legal threats. So the focus is a little different. So a little bit more about extrusion detection. This was actually a term coined by Terry Schmidt from New York City Wireless. He's actually sitting right up there. So it's basically an IDS watching outbound traffic, right? What I already said. Snort's out there. Snort's a great open source IDS that's already available. It's already got thousands of rules available for watching for bad traffic. All you do is you install it and you tell it to monitor your WAN link instead of your Ethernet link. Flip it around. Sometimes you have to update the rules to watch the other way around. But basically, it's all there. When Snort says, hey, I've seen bad traffic, there's some Perl scripts. There's Guardian and another one, which basically when it sees bad traffic, it'll do something. And in this case, you just update the firewall. And this is now running, up and running on one of New York City Wireless's public nodes. So, and it seems to be working. So how does the active portal work? Basically, it works the same as the captive portal. The difference is they're still forced to the web page. There's no username and password to enter, though. So they just say, I accept the terms of use. You assign a cookie so that the node operator can see how many people are actually live at their site and get stats. And it's also a way for if people are being bad and they're dumb and don't know how to delete cookies, you can still control them. you update the firewall just like you do, and you rate limit the user. Same thing. So the other problem is how do you protect from legal threats? What happens if someone spams? What happens if someone starts trading kiddie porn? What happens if any number of bad things that happen over the internet happen from your free node that you're providing to the public? Well, bottom line is there's not a whole lot you can do. One thing you can do is use something like Freedom from Zero Knowledge Systems so that nobody knows where the bad traffic is coming from. It doesn't solve the problem, but it means that nobody knows it was you. So unfortunately, Freedom just acts their Linux client, which sucks, but there are other options. Did they? Right on. All right. So the good things. This is even simpler than the captive portal. Right? All it is a redirection, port 80 redirection, a default deny all rule, and you update that. Right? There's no user database. You don't have to worry about people stealing usernames and passwords. You don't have to worry about maintaining transactions. You don't have to do any of that stuff. It doesn't matter. It's open. All they have to do is click accept. It meshes better with the idea of an open network. You know, why are you building an open network that people have to log into? Abuse will be caught. So regardless, there is no username and password to identify. The only actual identifiable things you have are an IP address, which you assign, and a MAC address, which they can forge, right? So the whole idea here is you don't bother identifying the user, really. All you do is if they do something bad, you kill that session. Okay, it still protects the node operator. You can protect them from network abuse, bandwidth abuse. They can protect themselves from legal abuse if they can point their traffic out some sort of anonymizing service. It's very hackable. It's very scalable. It's very simple. The bad, because there's no usernames, it's harder to turn off service, right? It is harder to identify people. It's harder to restrict access, again, for the same reasons. And the biggest two things is there's no encryption now because you're not doing VPN. But really, as far as I'm concerned, encryption, that's the user's responsibility. You're providing network access. If they want to pop their mail, that's their problem. And the biggest thing from a security point of view, and this makes everybody that does security as their job cringe, is that it's reactive instead of proactive, right? You're now in the situation where you're allowing everything, you're watching for bad things, and when bad things happen, you have to take action. That's a horrible situation to be in from a public network, for us, from a security standpoint. We're taking the gamble because what we're trying to do is we've decided that we don't have to be perfect, right? If we can stop 80, 90% of the abuse, that's enough that hopefully we won't be a sitting target, right? What we want, you know, ISPs don't stop 80 or 90% of the abuse that come out of their networks, right? All we have to be is no worse than anybody else, and people won't come to us to abuse us, right? That's what we don't want. So originally, Bruce and I were going to write this software. We both got really busy with new jobs, and that kind of got put on the back burner. And in the meantime, a bunch of other people have done it for us. Here's some software. There's LANROAMER, which is done by a company down in San Francisco. There's SLAN, which does VPN stuff. There's NetLogon out of... you can't see it? Oh, that sucks. Oh, shit. Yeah, come see us afterwards. I'll give those to you if you want them. Or they're on our website. Oh, where's back? Back. Back. Backspace. All right. So there are a few, because there's a lot of stuff with my name next to it when we were thrashing out captive portals. I get a lot of email, and pretty much any time somebody writes one, somebody emails me and says, hey, can I see your code? And I say, well, I don't have any, but I'd like to use yours. So nobody's written an active portal actual package yet. Terry's working on it. He's basically got all the pieces working. It just hasn't been put together. Wireless Heartbeat, this guy just emailed me about it a couple days ago. It looks kind of cool. And NoCat, who I don't think are here, they're a California-based community network. They've written what they're calling their catch-and-release software, which all fits on a floppy disk, and it's basically just a hacked Linux router project. Active portal software, coming. And I think that is the end.
No, it's still. We're still going. We're still going.
Oh, sorry, that's the
no.
FD.
No. All right. Involved in putting out public networks, I came to realize that I'm not the only one doing one, but happened to meet these guys first. And they were, in fact, talking about similar things. So here I am. My focus today are going to be a couple of things. Trying to actually prevent people from choosing, say, possibly a protocol that would be less advantageous to their use. There's actually a couple of them out there that are still usable that are not 802.11 based. And I'm not saying that security through obscurity is something you should probably shoot for in your network. I'm saying that it's worth considering for backbone links, things that aren't going to be provisioning client access, things that aren't that last mile or last block in this case. I wanted to talk a little bit about some current features present in 802.11 networks that kind of scare me, or not networks, but in the hardware that's used to provide these services that scare me a little bit. And a couple implementation subtleties that I've noticed on a couple bridges that have been actually deployed in my locale. First protocol I want to talk about that's a little aged but still pretty cool is RLAN. Anybody who remembers Telzon or Aeronet before Cisco bought them will probably have used RLAN at some point, if they didn't know it. It existed in the 900 MHz ISM band and the 2.4 GHz band now, but before 802.11 IEEE committee got going, this was basically the only good solution for putting out a big network and have it do anything very useful. Short rundown of the protocol is, as bridges exist in the network, they more or less mesh together in a unidirectional fashion, but they are aware of their neighbors at all times. It's kind of like, yes? I did not know that. Thank you. I'll have to buy him a beer then. At any rate, the RLAN protocol is pretty useful in exactly what we're talking about here today, and that is small metropolitan networks or small community networks. The network that I come from, the PRIC organization, sorry. It's the only good one you can come up with. At that network, we use RLAN exclusively, and it was kind of a chance occurrence that a company that did kiosks and malls in Milwaukee and Chicago area happened to have an employee near us who experienced working for them as they went on a business with a lot of the downward spiral. And he had a large truck full of RLAN gear, and they didn't ask for it back after 60 days. It gets better. These bridges are very useful. We'll get to why they're fun anyway a little bit later. So we set up these bridges ad hoc, not knowing really much about wireless initially. This is about a year and a half ago now, and it's been running great ever since we put it out. But the topology, essentially, as you construct a network, self-learns neighbors and self-determines the best path. It always, basically, as bridges are deployed, they will link to each other in more of an ad hoc fashion, but always go after trying to reduce hop count. Basically, each radio in this case is a repeater at this point, and also has a local Ethernet port, which can be used for client access at that home. But as far as why the protocol is cool is because it does all of this for you, and also it's above the layers that users can actually interact with. What comes out of the Ethernet port is data that they can't actually use to determine topology. They can't actually tell how many hops they're down unless they have administrative access to some sort of console login, some terminal port on the device itself, or can read SNMP communities out of the thing. The topology, as it rolls out, as you have a central root node and attach repeaters and access points alike, basically detects the topology via a spanning tree protocol. So it's a standards-based protocol, although it never makes its way down to the user, which is very, very ideal in this case. As far as packets flowing through the network, unlike 802.11, the entire system operates at one flat bit rate, which is a good and a bad at the same time. I don't know if this is a protocol-specific implementation or a vendor-specific radio implementation, but as far as I've seen, all RLAN radios operate at one speed throughout the entire network. As we've seen, 802.11 can associate from 11, 5.5, 2, and 1. You do waste a lot of time determining what bit rate you can communicate at. You waste a lot of time sensing failed packet receives. You sense a lot of time with HMAC error reception. In RLAN, you transmit it at one bit rate, and if you don't hear it, you just send it again. Very simple. As far as message types in the network, broadcasts are sent at the same rate on 802.11, if you weren't aware of it, but most 802.11 gear I've seen, as far as the specification says, broadcast frames are always handled at the lowest possible bit rate, which is 1 megabit. Even the 56 megabit stuff coming out will still send broadcasts at 1 megabit. This is for whatever reason, I don't understand this, but I believe there's no intelligence in the bridges to determine the lowest possible association present and send the frame back out at that lowest known association. They just default to 1 megabit. RLAN doesn't. A broadcast is no more expensive on the medium than a unicast or a multicast frame. As far as radio interoperation, 802.11 has some cool performance hacks. Some of you might have heard about short preamble support on the newer Intel and Cisco hardware. This doesn't work when you mix it. It's a great gain in terms of if you want absolutely minimal latency present between nodes, especially when you're repeating. This is very good to get on a large, you know, network in the middle of nowhere, because you're going to be talking long distances anyway and probably a lot of loss. So having short preambles are good. With Aeronet, or at least with RLAN, you can actually specify preambles in terms of time, not bits. from 1 microsecond to 1,000 microseconds. Unlike AR211 that has fixed preambles, or long or short, you can actually mix and match preambles depending on what your links are doing. Client access can operate with lower latency, whatever. Hidden node problems, especially when you deploy networks that can't hear each other, all the nodes are kind of distant. That mechanism for reserving media is built into the protocol. One slide I didn't make is something that I would like to mention also is CarlBridge. Have anybody used CarlBridge stuff before? Oh, okay. Well, you should try it. They have a very nice dynamic pooling protocol. And again, a lot of these things where you have lots of nodes contending for bandwidth are hard to resolve with a protocol that can't necessarily hear all of the constituent parties. Ethernet's great that way. Wireless stuff isn't quite so gifted. As far as CarlBridge, they address this problem of hidden nodes and media reservation with an adaptation on top of 802.11, which actually will exclusivate your network from people just roaming by and associating, which is actually another interesting thing I didn't bring up before, and that is choosing alternate protocols is security through obscurity, which is weak, but it's just really, really hard to buy the stuff. You just can't take an 802.11 card and adapt. You have to be specifically going after this. So unless someone can directly tell you're running the software, a passerby won't know. So it's yet another secret to toss into the mix. Don't base your security on that, though. But do consider RLAN or CarlBridge if you're rolling out big networks now. The stuff is cheap. You can find the RLAN bridges on eBay for $100, $200 now. We'll get to why they're more fun later. Did some specific firmware monkeying, and it's kind of cool what you can do. Anyway, as far as current stuff, one of the things that hit me when I started reviewing bridges for AR211 is a lot of the physical security concerns just are not addressed. A lot of the cheap bridges from a company called Umitcom, which is www.umitcom.com, spelled like it is, are great for people to quickly turn out a product. Umitcom will sell you a bridge. You can say, I want the color purple on my case, and I want this style antenna, and you'll get that. And you'll get their standard MIB writing software because they're programmed through SNMP initially. And that's great and good for your company to roll out and do quickly. Problem is, Umitcom's stock hardware has a couple of issues. One is local comm support is always accessible. It is not passworded yet. I don't think they'll change that. People who are deploying Umitcom bridges are oftentimes using the older 2 megabit style. They don't support WEP either, and they can't. There's no space left in the firmware. They already have a 8 megabit flash storing 8 and some odd megabits of compressed kernel, so that's not cool. The hardware is a constraint in that case. They can't actually increase feature sets. As far as the local comm support, it's an IT command set. You send AT commands to the device. It changes radio frequency. It shows you WEP keys. You program WEP keys, etc. Other configuration for most bridges is still horrible. SNMP is clear text, as is Telnet. You're going to toss this over the air when you're doing any repeating. So if you have a big network with lots of nodes all the way out there with clients on local Ethernet ports, you're always going to have stuff flowing through the air for management. You just can't get away from that. To my knowledge, no one makes an SSH-enabled bridge yet. I don't understand why. Other things to concern yourself with doing a public network is this. You want to be a good RF citizen. When you're amplifying signals to increase your distances, or of course staying below legal power, you will always want to employ bandpass filtering, even if it's a cheap set of chokes and capacitors. You will definitely want to stop spurious harmonic emission. If you have businesses in your area, not that they have to accept your interference, you might get a lot of flack from them, and your town board may actually ask you to stop, and if you don't stop, they may somehow try to force you. Local ordinances can sometimes modify or change federal rules, as far as I've seen. So do concern yourself with being a good RF citizen. You don't want to toss out trash. You want to actually spend the time researching amplifiers, making sure that the output is actually as clean as it says it is, maybe. Finding people who have done third-party tests is possible. There are companies in the net like Teletronics who sell amplifiers, resell amplifiers that actually are spectrally tested per unit, and you can get the thing, and it's basically a NIST-certified calibrated device that does the spectrum analysis. So it is possible to get good gear. Another thing that that kind of concerns me, and this is the RF and the subtleties in some of the diversity operations that radios have. Who has any access points at home with two antennas on them? Just raise your hands. Okay, great. If some people have diversity antenna systems, I've noticed that in deployed regions in Wisconsin, people are using sectoral antennas, directional antennas on each port. And that's great, because one bridge now has two antennas which are very focused on small areas of space. And diversity basically is the radio's ability to sample all RF data on a channel and determine which one of the ports receives the best data within the preamble. So as the frame is being received through the air, that first 128 bits of the frame is where you decide which antenna you'll continue to receive the frame through. Newer bridges, you get even more fancy. They actually have transmit diversity. So if they last heard a frame from radio station XYZ, MAC address AA, whatever, they will retransmit a resulting frame to that station through the last antenna they heard the good message from. That in itself is a great feature. You can take two sectoral antennas with one AP, cover a much larger area with higher gain per antenna than two OMNIs or any kind of variation on diversity at that point. The problem with this is you can starve nodes by announcing yourself as the radio you want to starve. If you have two sectoral antennas on an access point and tell the access point that antenna A isn't the best way to send a packet or a frame back out to my node, I'm going to announce packets at the AP from the side that I'm on saying, I am this man over here, and it will then not issue frames back at this user on the first antenna port. So diversity has subtle issues. If you're deploying diverse systems, it's great to use antenna diversity. You can get really, really high bit rates with this stuff because you can reduce multipath to almost a negligible effect. But keep that in mind if you're scaling this to a large size. People will probably not do this, but that's definitely a subtlety within diversity that Intel or Cisco, as far as I've talked with last, at least Cisco Tech didn't know what diversity really was. So, okay, I'm sorry, we have like 2 minutes left, so I'll just race through this. And then the last page, of course, is more URLs you can't see because they're light blue, but I'll hand it back off to Bruce here. And if there's any questions, please just ask in the remaining few minutes.
Yeah, we'll take questions. First, there's a message for Paul Burns at the NOC, so if you're Paul Burns, go to the NOC. They have something fun and exciting for you. Questions, sir?
To my knowledge, Carl Bridge is nothing more than 802.11 radios that have been supplied to the company and that they know a lot of interesting ways to adapt the radio's output to. Carbridge is just a protocol add-on to 802.11, really, and provides a couple cool functions for big repeated networks. Yes?
Sorry, what's the business model for the personal telco thing? There is no business model. It's a community network. It's done for free, for love, just 'cause. Yeah, well, this is Matt Peterson from the Barrier Wireless Users Group. He just wanted to give you guys a quick show of what's been happening down there.
Yeah, so Adam asked me to show some pictures real quick of what we've been doing since we've been seeing a lot of slides here. So real quickly, Baywug started out as a group of about 12 people. This is at Critical Path. Started with about 30 or 40 people at Napster. Now we've got about 80 people at the meetings. We're doing basically kind of hardware hacking. This is Power or Ethernet. Lucent will make this for you for a couple $100, so you can do it for about $10 from Parts from Fry's. Put your access point outdoors, so you've got the Power Ethernet on a Pelican case. This is nice for kind of hiding it up there. Up at the top, you'll note that I've taken the LEDs and extended them so I can actually see if it's working in the middle of the night. One of the things that's a problem with access points right now is the software is not made in the U.S. Most of the firmware is pretty shitty. So the idea is that we're going to roll our own access points, and getting a hardware platform to do that is quite hard. And we were looking originally at doing like 46s and building these captive portals. The problem with that is every 46 might have an ISA card or a PCI card or who knows what's in it. So the concept is that we'll standardize on hardware. So we're looking at getting basically custom motherboards made. This is about a 5x4-inch motherboard. You've got an AMD compact flash. It's 46133. DC power, console, Ethernet, PCMCIA. So this is basically the way to build your access point. It's about $250. We're doing a couple kind of links. Whether or not they're legal is another question. This is between Hayward and Millbrae in the Bay Area. It's a 20-mile link. It does work. This basically shows access points. Baywug doesn't officially build networks. We give you the knowledge and the power to do it, and we don't want to take any legal responsibility for it. So essentially what people have done is put access points throughout San Francisco, a couple places in the peninsula and Berkeley. And these are people that just have their DSL and their airport and their, you know, basically sharing it out free of charge, and they don't really care what you do. This is Peter Shipley. He's got a presentation, very interesting, what he's doing, doing both the word driving and kind of long-range security analysis. Who else? So these links you can actually see. We've got Personal Telco, which is Adam's project in Portland. NYC Wireless is Terry up in the front here. Seattle Wireless, we've got some folks there. BC Wireless, British Columbia. NoCat.net up is in Sebastopol, California, obviously the home of O'Reilly. They've already got a capture portal software that they showed on Thursday night at the BayWug meeting. So probably within the week we'll have a capture portal software where you can run this intrusion detection and whatnot. And that's me. Thanks. So, are we out of time? All right. If anybody has questions or wants to come up and talk to us, just come on up afterwards and we'll be happy to talk to you. Thanks a lot.